WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial is perhaps America's most beloved monument. Visitors are often moved to tears as they find the names of loved ones among the names of the nearly 58,000 dead and missing inscribed on the monument's granite walls. The monument was designed by my guest Maya Lin when she was a 20-year-old architecture student. Her design was chosen in a competition that drew over 1,400 entries. She since designed a civil rights memorial for the Southern Poverty Law Center and a sculpture commissioned by Yale University to commemorate the opening of the university to women. She's created many public artworks and has recently begun building houses. Lin is the daughter of Chinese-born parents, a family of artists and scholars. Her parents fled China in the 40s and located in Ohio. An Academy Award-winning documentary about Lin is opening theatrically. It's called Maya Lin, A Strong, Clear Vision. I asked Maya Lin if she's ever surprised by people's reactions to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
I think the one thing I could never have predicted in a million years is how people leave objects at the place. But the reality is whenever I make a piece, no matter what, all I'm concerned about is how one person one-on-one is going to dialogue with the piece. I have actually never thought about any of my works in terms of a collective general response. And in that sense, I'm very private, and I always think of these works as being very private. And no matter how public they are, one experiences them one-on-one. But what I never think about is the kind of the larger picture, or say the media response to it, or that the books being written about it, or any, you know, it's just something I don't really think about ever.
You were a student when you did the proposal for the Vietnam Memorial. Did you expect to get a grade instead of a commission?
I got a grade, and then I decided to enter it in the competition.
Oh, you did get a grade first.
Oh, I did.
What was your grade?
No, I'm not going to say.
Oh, come on.
It was a grade for the entire course. It's I got a B. He didn't like my work. The professor thought it was all too strong.
Too strong?
Uh-huh.
Well, what's bad about being strong?
I don't know. I think he preferred, it was a course on funereal architecture. I think at the time I was doing a lot that dealt with conceptual levels of experiencing mourning, and my works came off, again, it was that same comment, we want something happy, not something sad. And I wanted to do things not necessarily sad, but I wanted to do things that were very focused on truth and how you could only have a catharsis if you go through some sort of a painful acceptance or acknowledgement of the pain of a loss or something like that.
You were pretty young when you designed the memorial to really understand the sense of catharsis and loss and reflection that you expressed so well in the piece. And I was wondering if this was just kind of purely artistic impulse, or if you'd been through that kind of experience yourself.
I wouldn't call it an artistic impulse. I think it was an abstract impulse. I think I understood, though I had never gone through an actual loss due to death. I hadn't experienced it myself. I felt at the time it was going to be the most painful thing to lose someone. And then how can you bring someone back? And my attitude was, a name will bring everything back about that person you ever knew.
And that's why you went for a wall of names.
Well, no, the names were also required as part of the competition. But, see, I actually designed it for a class and then entered it. It just seems that it worked, that what they wanted and what I had designed worked out. And I knew it wasn't going to win. So I was doing it more to make a statement. I was doing it for myself. But there was no way that it would ever get selected.
Shows what you know.
Absolutely. Not very good in that aspect.
What was the conceptual statement you set out to make with the design for the memorial?
It took me, I designed the piece, and then it took me longer to write about it, and I submitted a one-page written description that goes into a lot about what I was trying to say in the piece. And essentially, I'm fairly convinced. It's this one-page written statement that convinced the jurors to go with the piece.
Why don't we hear a clip of the documentary, Maya Lin, A Strong, Clear Vision, in which you're actually reading from that proposal.
The memorial is composed not as an unchanging monument, but as a moving composition, to be understood as we move into and out of it. The passage itself is gradual, the descent to the origin slow. But it is at the origin that the meaning of this memorial is to be fully understood. At the intersection of these walls, on the right side at the wall's top, is carved the date of the first death. It is followed by the names of those who have died in the war in chronological order. It is up to each individual to resolve or come to terms with this loss, for death is in the end a personal and private matter. And the area contained within this memorial is a quiet place meant for personal reflection and private reckoning.
That's Maya Lin reading from her Vietnam Veterans Memorial proposal from the documentary A Strong, Clear Vision. When your design won the contest for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, people who didn't like the design called it a degrading ditch, a wall of shame, a black scar. Ross Perot, who in part funded the competition, organized a demonstration against your design. You were still a young artist. Did you take this personally? What did it do to your sense of confidence in yourself as a person, in your own work?
I guess I wouldn't even say I was a young artist. I was still forming. I hadn't even understood how much art was going to pull me. I just believed in it. I think the one graceful thing about youth is that you are so sure that you are right, that in that what you're doing is good. I think I really believed the truth of accepting all these names and being able to experience it in a certain way would really be helpful. And that's all I believed in at the time. And I think perhaps had I been older, doubt would have begun to creep in. But I think when you're that young, you're incredibly stubborn.
Now, what about the more personal slurs? For instance, somebody said, how can we let a gook design a Vietnam veterans memorial?
I wasn't aware of those until much, I would say 9 months into being in this Washington fight. And so it was kept from me. And I guess, obviously, when I found out, it's disturbing. It's upsetting. It's upsetting to know that though you are born in this country and you are an American, certain races are always going to be looked at as saying you're an other. That aside from the fact that the racial slurs are ugly and they're really, really sad. But I think it doesn't make me angry. I mean, it makes me sad, but it doesn't make me angry.
At the dedication ceremony, your name was never mentioned, and the program book had a picture of the statues, not of the monument you designed. How did you feel about that?
Pretty upset. I was more upset that my family was there, and we were horribly shunted off into a press box with cameras all around, and it was just very unpleasant an experience. It's the only time in all the dedications since where there was just so much almost not acceptance of authorship of the fact that I had authored this piece. It's almost like, now we like it. It's now ours. And it was painful to know that you had fought so hard to get something through, not because of ego, but because you believed in something and to have that happen. But I think what then happened with, say, the dedication of the Civil Rights Memorial was the exact opposite of that. And I think sometimes you have to persevere, and the next time out, it sort of makes up for it.
After the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, you still had to finish school. You weren't done with graduate school yet.
I hadn't even started.
Oh, you're still in undergraduate school.
I graduated from Yale undergrad, but I then took time off to build the memorial.
Now, were offers pouring in to do other memorials?
I think every time there's been a disaster of some sort, a request has always been coming in. I really wasn't going to do any more memorials. In fact, I've only done technically won since the Vietnam, and it's a civil rights memorial. I knew for me that I really, those pieces, the civil rights in Vietnam, are about history, about politics, about time. So is a piece I did for Yale, which deals with co-education. I, per se, do not want to get typecast for the rest of my life as being a memorial builder. I was fascinated with certain aspects of our history. A lot of it, again, deals with chronologies and times, which is something I'm very interested in my work. But I really had every intention to sort of move on into architecture and art.
My guess is Maya Lin, the documentary about her called Maya Lin, A Strong, Clear Vision, which won an Academy Award, is now a theatrical film coming to theaters. And Maya Lin designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, several other memorials, many public sculptures. We'll take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Maya Lin. She designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Her latest work of public art, Wave Field, is outside of the University of Michigan's College of Engineering.
It's essentially sculpted earth, and it's also it's in front of a building dedicated to a man, Francois Xavier Bagdoun, who lost his life in a helicopter crash. And I guess the building frames a courtyard of grass. The courtyard is about, I would say, 2 acres, no, maybe 1.5 acres. And I wanted to explore the notion of aerodynamics. And so much of flight is about turbulence and resistance, too, in order for us to take off. And though I had done a lot of research on aerodynamics and talked to a lot of the professors that were there, the classrooms overlook this site. I just hit upon it one day, and this is usually what happens. I research something for 2 or 3 months, I don't have an idea of what I want to do, and then I see it, and it's pretty instantaneous, and I saw this one very repetitive, naturally occurring wave. It's called a Stokes wave, and all of a sudden, images of everything from Escher to Solowit came to play, because here's a natural phenomena that looks completely regular, and I thought, what if I recreate this? What if I transform this into a piece that you can actually get into? And it actually takes the notion of fluidity, solidifies it, and it's all pure earth and then grass. And each wave is large enough so that one person can sit in a wave and, say, read a book. And so it, again, invites interaction. It's fairly playful, but at the same time, it ties directly into what's going on within the building itself.
You have a piece called Groundswell that's like a glass garden sculpture at the Wexner Center for the Arts at Ohio State University in Columbus. And there's 43 tons of glass fragments
right. In
this. And I kept thinking, what was it like when the truck started pulling up with the 43 tons of glass that you had ordered? I mean, when you're dealing in that scale, is there a moment of terror as the objects actually arrive and you hope that they will be what you imagine?
There was a moment of terror for the months leading up to this one. This piece is really special for me. The director asked me to do their first permanent art installation there. And they had been very aware of these smaller scaled works I've always been working on that consist of lead, broken car glass, tempered glass is square, it's not sharp shards, and beeswax. And the idea was, can I bring the aesthetic of these private works out into the public realm? I had been working with this broken car glass for many years in these smaller works, never been able to find a place where I could pour them, because after all, it is still glass. You want people to look at it, but you really don't want them to have access to it. So the idea was, can I make art in full view of everyone and not plan it? Unlike all the works that had come before, where it takes me years to draw something up and have someone else fabricate it, for this time around, I barely had an idea of what it would look like, and I was going to allow the process of the pouring form and shape what these pieces would look like. So it was incredibly unnerving, because I thought, this 43 tons are going to show up, and I'm going to make a mess. And it's in 3 different levels. So we had cranes, ladders, roofers because I figured the car, the car glass is actually very much like roofing gravel. And so they thought I was sort of, I think they thought I was a little insane at the time, but then they really got into it, and it meant being on site for a week or two, pouring out these gardens of glass, which actually are again a mix of my East-West heritage. The Eastern is the Japanese gardens in Kyoto, which I find just so beautiful, and then again the Southeastern Ohio, the rolling hills, the burial mounds, the landscape that sort of begins to kind of rise up under you and undulate, and that's where the name of the piece comes into, Groundswell, which is on the ocean. As a wave almost begins to form, that's what it's called, and you can begin to see it taking shape in the flatness of the water. A lot of my pieces deal with fluidity.
Happy with the way it turned out?
Very.
Are all the glass pieces glued together at all?
No, it is a piece that, in a way, conceptually, has the lifetime of an academic year. It's a gravity pour piece. You poured the glass on, they shaped into separate mounds, and I would dictate how large each mound got. Due to the fact that it's a gravity pour piece, at the end of an academic year, they take anything that's settled from the bottom and repoint each top. So it is an erosion piece that sort of incorporates an academic school year into its shaping. Hmm. And it will gradually settle and change over time. But it's in that sense like a Japanese raked garden. It requires a fair amount of maintenance. But because it is a museum, the preparators were able to discuss this with me in advance and give me the type of care that a piece like this would require. Whereas, say, the wave field out in Michigan, though they will have to mow it a careful way, it's much more, it will stay in place much, much better.
Since you've designed a lot of public spaces where people can go to reflect, whether it's reflecting on civil rights or the war or on nature or on whatever they choose to reflect on, is there a place that you particularly like to go to? To reflect, that gives you the type of feeling that you'd like other people to feel when they...
I think there are a couple, and I think anytime I come across a really beautiful natural landscape, I'm incredibly humbled, because I think nature is so magical and so beautiful, and that I just hope we all can respect it. And so I think I've been at very, very magical places, whether it's where the land meets the ocean or just overlooking a simple forest glade, where I think the beauty inherent is something I can never compete with, and that I hope that I respect the landscape and nature in that end.
So you don't want to compete with nature, but I guess you do want to work with it.
I want to work with it. Or shall I say that I will be humble, and that maybe this is just something I believe in, that I wouldn't say that anything I could do could ever be better than what exists in nature, because I think it's so stunningly beautiful. So I want to be sort of humble in how I approach. I mean, I'm just stunned when I look out at the ocean and the complexity and the waves. And I think we are at a stage where we have been seriously impacting upon the planet we're on. And I would hope that we could be more aware of it, more sensitive to it.
Tell me something about your house and what you've designed as an interior environment for yourself to live in. Is it a nice space, or do you just make do with something?
It's a loft. It's on the funky side. I'm experimenting with a lot of industrial materials. Like, I live in a part of New York which is a fairly industrial part, so I get a lot of my materials from there. It's always, I'm constantly renovating it and playing with it and experimenting with new materials. It's got a lot of light. It's the top floor with, and it's an old building, so trying to rework and reuse a lot of the tin and slate that was in the existing building. So a lot of it is sort of taking what's there and reworking it at times. So I was able to like recycle a lot of stone into the building. But for the most part, I've done less in New York than in another place I have in Vermont, which is, I'm renovating it to be much more energy efficient, all natural materials, focusing on bringing more light into the building so you can use, you know, less electricity, things like that.
Maya Lin, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Maya Lin is the subject of an Academy Award-winning documentary called Maya Lin, A Strong, Clear Vision. It's now playing in Washington, D.C. It opens in New York tomorrow and in more cities next week. This is Fresh Air.